Hello, and welcome to the Global Sport Matters podcast. This is Ken Shropshire, and this is part one of Breaking the Fix, a story of segregated baseball in South Africa from host Jerome Allen and Gallery 35 Media. Part two is also out today as part of our October field study and digital issue titled Rediscovering America's Pastime here at the Global Sport Institute. Hey, Jerome, great that you did this. This story is really personal to you. Why don't you share a little bit about why you wanted to share this with the audience?
I lived in South Africa for a year after I graduated college. And in my time there, I played for a baseball team called the Athlone Athletics in a South African colored township just outside of Cape Town. And as I played throughout the year and through the season with the team, I became to start learning and thinking, wow, you know, what can we learn about our experience with segregated baseball here in America from this experience with segregated baseball in South Africa? So I wanted to bring this story to light to try to bring some communities closer together, as well as tell a cool story about baseball.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by the parallels of what has happened in South Africa since apartheid ended, and kind of try to parallel all that with the United States. And I don't know what the end date is in the United States, but maybe the Civil Rights Act '64, maybe the bus boycotts. But it's always fascinating to hear this. For people who haven't been to South Africa, the sports connection is ultra fascinating, and many know some of those stories. And Jerome, just before we get started, who are we going to hear from in this one?
So in part one, we're going to hear from two of the founders of the Athlone Athletics Club, Sean Campbell and Mervyn Vidal. They were the first people in the rooms kind of putting all the resources together to start this club and build it to what it is now. So you're going to hear from them, as well as Lou Moore, who is a historian here in America who specializes in African-American history, particularly through the lens of sports and Negro League baseball.
Well, great combination. Lou is one of the best professors around, focused on these issues. So thanks, Jerome. And with that, here's part one of Breaking the Fix, a story of segregated baseball in South Africa.
Give some context to Athlone, the neighborhood, or just the history of kind of how everyone kind of got to that area, how it started, and whether it was, I don't know if you guys experienced land removals or the kind of forced evacuations, but could you describe what that experience may or may not have been like?
Okay, let's start on the apartheid scene that we're probably going to allude to. Is that apartheid up to the 70s, where people were evacuated from their homes and set up in various locations. You were probably privy to locations right next to where Athlone is situated. The Athlone clubhouse is situated, and Langa was one of the locations. To take it further than that, at our age, I'm talking Sean's age, my age, and Darren, we weren't really affected by those movements back where people were kicked out of their houses. It is more our parents and our parents' parents. In fact, my parents weren't affected by it at all, but I do know about it.
The forced removals impacted my grandparents, not my parents as well, impacted my grandparents. So the Athlone area where you were familiar with, it's commonly known as the Cape Flats area. It was the flat ground. People stayed closer to the mountain, and the white folk moved them away from the mountain, away from the beaches, away from the main CBD area. And it became the Cape Flats, which is very, very broad. Square meters, I wouldn't know, probably 40 kilometer squares.
If not more.
If not more.
In the brief sense of the word, it's if we go back to the apartheid regime, they were Europeans. The light-skinned people were Europeans. Anybody not light-skinned or not from Europe was classified as non-European. And then non-Europeans were also classified as colored, which was more as a mixed race, as a skin color between black, as in black African, and white.
Sean and Mervyn, can you tell me, were you politically involved at all in the movements against apartheid?
My contact with the political scene was more in 1976 with the school riots. I was in matric in my last year at school in 1976.
And for listeners who don't know, matric is short for matriculation and is the South African equivalent of senior year of high school.
So that gave me more insight to the political flavors of the time. Not that I'm politically minded at all, but I have friends who are very politically minded and who led our school's political protests and movements.
Mm. Could more about those movements for me and kind of give some, what were you fighting against? What were you fighting for in those political movements?
So we were fighting for better education. We were fighting for our black communities, which was out in Soweto, wanting Afrikaans out of the school curriculum, being Xhosa and Zulu speakers, because that was their big fight. And, you know, we sort of alluded to that as well. So we were broadly up against the apartheid regime, fighting for the release of Nelson. You know, that was the ultimate goal, the ultimate aim.
For me, when I got over there and then everyone's kind of speaking Afrikaans to me, people looking at me a certain type of way, then I start talking, then they realize I'm American, and it's a whole different set of politics. But my understanding of it, really, I mean, in America, we had things like the one drop rule, right? Post, you know, slavery or post kind of integration or whatever it is. And you have, how do you define someone as black in America, right? Any type of black descent and you're considered to be African-American or, you know, a bunch of, I feel like in America, a lot of people of color, even of, you know, Native American descent have been looped into just, you know, this black category. In South Africa during the apartheid regime, there was different definitions for, you know, white, black, non-Europeans, and the black community is like the ethnically indigenous descendants of like the descendants of the indigenous African community, and the color community I've found to be a lot like the black community here in terms of being divorced from your own history and your forefathers and knowing kind of who or where you come from, but then looped into this group that's defined by rules, right? Like we had the one drop rule. I know during apartheid, you know, they run a comb through your hair and see, you know, where it stops to see if you could be considered colored, right? Those type of definitive things to decide if someone should be a part of this cultural group or that economic group, et cetera, determine color people. So thank you for giving that context to that. So now on to the big topic of baseball. Could you both tell me when you started playing baseball, what baseball was like when you were a kid, even before matric, and as you started to get into more political revolutions, what the baseball community was like amongst colored people?
Okay. Let's go to the old guy. I'm the old guy. So I started out as a baseball spectator, having a cousin playing baseball At that time, there were only colored clubs, so at the one venue. And everybody played at one venue. So I must have been in a pram at the time in 58, 59, 60, around about the 60s. And I started playing at the age of 13. Having spent many years as a bat boy for one of the clubs, no junior baseball, no youth baseball. It was 13 years old and hit out with the big boys. So there was no, you know, there was no distinction between youth. It was just a matter of playing baseball. I progressed from that and I played, I think, how long did I play at that? I played till about the the late 70s. I played at the one unit, which was probably at 16 clubs. And then there were two other units in Cape Town specific. one other unit at the time out in Wynberg, and a third unit in Port Elizabeth. And that was the makeup of colored baseball in South Africa.
Just to clarify, so there's obviously your Cape Flat community baseball leagues and teams, but there were also leagues in other parts of the country that were only colored as well. So Port Elizabeth is on the eastern coast of South Africa, if I'm correct, right? So a bit of a drives away from Cape Town, but you were connected to that league and those teams on the side of the country.
Well, eventually connected, eventually. They played their league there. We played our league out in Crawford, and there was another league out in Wynberg. To give context, you're probably looking at a difference of 10, 15 kilometers. The one was called Western Province, out in Crawford, and the other one was called Cape District. So those were two units. Those two units played against each other as a provincial playoff. Although we were in the same province, we had a provincial playoff. And later on, in latter years, Eastern Province came on board as well. So there were three units that played as a national competition.
Colored, two from
only colored, two in Cape Town, one from PE.
Nice.
And later in the 80s, early 80s, Mitchell's Plain, which was a big colored community that was created, they started their own baseball unit there as well. And that being people who had migrated from the Athlone area, the Maitland area, going out to Mitchell's Plain, they then started their baseball unit there, giving you three units in the Cape Town area.
Got you. I remember riding through Mitchell's Plain and a little bit further out toward the what beach is that? Musenberg? It's more towards
Musenberg,
right. And so in context, it's not entirely far from Athlone, but at the time,
about 7-8 kilometers.
Right. Can you both describe almost, right? So you describe this almost international, not this national competition between, you know, color programs and other areas. Can you describe what role was baseball playing in the community, right? As whether it would be as a spectator or when you started playing at 13, what did baseball mean to the colored community at large? In whatever way you think.
I think for a lot of baseballers, baseball was a secondary sport. They were soccer players, rugby players that didn't do anything during summer and didn't like the game of cricket. And baseball was another opportunity, another vehicle for them to exercise, stay in a team environment, and socialize. It was a big sport, was a big socializing and recreational thing on a weekend in most colored communities. And baseball just provided that in the summer months for the Cape Flats community. And a lot of people came down there and was, Roman says it was about 20 teams. But at the one venue, there were 20 baseball teams and 20 softball teams playing at one venue. So at any one time, you got 300-400 people at a venue.
So it was so clear to me how much of social life centered around baseball. And as you mentioned, you know, beyond that, I also saw how familiar baseball teams and leagues were. Could you speak to that a little more?
My parents played baseball and softball at the venue. So I often get reminded that my diapers were changed at the venue. Yeah. We all played for Wolves.
Yeah, this house is for Wolves, guy.
So I just want to pause the interview there and introduce a historian by the name of Lou Moore, who is going to give us some context to how the experience of South Africa may relate to the experience of baseball in America.
I'm a historian, and I'm a trained historian, to do black history, but I use sport as a way to look at these questions, right? Whether it's like working class black manhood or the civil rights movement. So whatever I'm interested in, I'm trying to figure out what's the sport angle, or if I'm looking at sports, I'm like, well, what's the larger, social implications that are going on, right? So when you talk about, for instance, playing Little League ball, I think about, you know, there's tons of guys, you know, if you look in the, like say the black press in the 50s and 60s and 70s, called Little League season, and it's, you know, it's in there. It's trying to raise money. It's really moms trying to hold it together. And then you think about space, right? It's the one way we look at sports is through space and public space. And what happens when those fields aren't there anymore? So we often talk about, you know, what happened to the black baseball player. We got to ask the larger question, what happened to space, how they play? As you say, as you transition yourself, transition from North Philly to Lower Merrimack, the space changes, your access to things change, but also that, like you said, the price point changes. And so that's what I like to do. I like to use the history that I know to look at kind of these current situations.
The word color doesn't necessarily mean the same thing it has meant here and does mean here. But in America, the word colored is still rooted in individuals with some sort of African blood ancestry in some way. And like kind of steeped in that somewhat of that gray area, right? Where again, like we have in America, we had the one drop rule where one drop of black blood and you're considered to be black. Over in South Africa, that was different. They have a racial denomination for those people. But I know looking at, you know, early artifacts from the Negro Leagues in history, a lot of the labeling of words was colored, right? Was the color, first colored World Series or whatever it was. Can you speak to the shift in that language from color to Negro, to what type of label they wanted to put on the people playing this game?
I think it's just interesting. I think part of it, when you look at words like colored Negro, do you capitalize the N in Negro, right, into black, into Afro, you know, Afro-American? I think it goes, I think colored Negro, colored Afro-American, black African-American, right? These are all terms used. And part of it is just, you know, black folks defining themselves, right? It's on the one hand, it's the white press, and the white press will say more than just colored and Negro. Let's be clear. Like a great example, the first time a white newspaper writes about a black newspaper, a black baseball game, it's 1862. It's the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, and they're calling the fans like pickaninnies. They're calling the players sambos, right? And so, you know, colored and Negro is a lot better than that, right? But let's define ourselves. So the first leagues that are started are, you know, these are colored leagues. But then the Negro leagues, as you say, the point I'll start, it's 1920s Negro leagues. And it's just a shift in terminology. It's just a shift in how I'm going to define myself. I'm Negro, right? And then when Negro doesn't cut it, when that's not good enough, I'm black. Right. And now we just call it, some people call it Negro Leagues, but a lot of times it's just black ball. It's just black ball, right? It's just something that kind of encompasses. I like the term black ball because it encompasses everything, right? It brings in the Afro-Latinos who maybe didn't consider themselves Negro, but they're still black, right? And it ties in the past where they're black teams playing each other or color teams. So the best way to actually find resources on black baseball, if you're looking in the 1860s, 1870s, is to type in colored ball or colored baseball. But black ball ties into the present too, right? When we talk about black baseball players, and we talk about young kids in little league, the Negro the All Star Game started in 1933. That's the black event of the year. Where everybody wants to go to Chicago to go and party and see the best players in really in the country, right? Regardless of race. But then on a micro level, look at something like Juneteenth. There's not a Juneteenth celebration in Texas that doesn't have baseball. It's barbecue and baseball, right? And I say that because we talk about community. Baseball was a community game, right? Juneteenth rolls around, June 19th rolls around in Texas. Like I said, there's two guarantees. You're going to get some barbecue and you're going to see a baseball game. And even Negro Leagues teams knew that weren't from Texas. So like a team like the Memphis Red Sox would regularly schedule their biggest game of the year in Texas on Juneteenth, because that's when they were guaranteed their biggest moneymaker. But even beyond that, local community teams, you go look at a newspaper in Texas, you put in Juneteenth in baseball, you're going to see tons of games, just guys getting together and creating, using that day, using that space to really claim what's there.
Thank you, Lou. Now, back to the guys in South Africa, as I wanted to learn more about exactly how their team came together. So here's Mervin and Sean.
The White Cloud believe they had this structure. We were playing community ball, and we were enjoying it, and we had the spectatorship for community ball. When we played in hindsight, I said it wasn't an amalgamation, it was a takeover. We joined what the Whites had, which we thought was better, but it actually wasn't.
So
we lost our identity.
When apartheid ends, and you're obviously playing baseball, and everything you do is segregated at that point, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
When the opportunity comes to start competing against the white teams in the Belleville areas, in the wine country, Constantia, yeah, yeah, or whatever it is, and Fishhook, etc., were you excited about it? Were you nervous? Were teams, you know, did they feel the pride to ready and go compete?
A little bit of excitement and nervousness because we don't know what to expect. And for all these years, we wanted to put ourselves against these guys who have claimed
superiority.
And being playing our sport on a communal field, we didn't have the mounds. We played the raised mound. We played over flat. So adjusting to the raised mound was a huge adjustment. And we looked silly at times. And we were exposed at times. But once we got used to it, there was no touching. We showed the superiority. Once we made the adjustment, we showed them where the superiority lied. And then they used the boardroom to shift us out of the superiority. You understand? They used the administration. They used all these tactics to keep you back, to hold you back.
Nullify.
Yeah, to dismiss you. They'll have meetings in obscure areas, knowing that it's a challenge for us to get off work, to get to meetings. So they frustrate you. They just piss you off that you walk away. You either walk, you can't fight it anymore because it's just so frustrating. I mean, I don't know about you. I can't make a 4 o'clock meeting because I work for the boss. But they don't work for bosses. They are bosses. They got the entitlement. So they can call a 4 o'clock meeting every Monday. So if you don't make it, well, you were invited to the meeting. You were not invited. So were they wrong or were they right? You know what I'm saying? That subtleness, that subtle deviousness that they came about.
So that subtle deviousness was a product of, you know, once you get let in to compete and then you're showing your superiority on the field. Now, Mervin, you mentioned a certain brand of baseball, right? A certain type of baseball that got mixed from the Dynamo and the Wolves. What was the brand of colored baseball, right? What separated you from the white teams and how they competed, even though they had resources and guys throwing fast, et cetera?
Yeah, remember, our guys never had the resources. We never had the equipment. We had a lot of hand-me-down stuff. We'd have an American friend that would bring something, be it a video, be it a film, be it a glove or some balls. That's how we got to learn about this game. And we didn't have the techniques. Our techniques that we developed was not from any book or any video footage. We had to develop our own sort of techniques and teach each other, you know, okay, try your swing this way or try and throw the ball that way or try and grip it that way. But we didn't follow. I must actually make a note here. Darren was about 17, 18 years old. I had finished my coaching stint with the club long before that. I was doing a bit of youth work. And Darren needed to do a level O coaching clinic. And I wanted to encourage him to go and do the clinic. And I went with. And I then also did the level O coaching. Remember, I coached for many years prior to that. And then the officer in charge wanted us to grip the ball in the, what's it, the U-shape? What do they call it? The horseshoe. The horseshoe grip. And I was looking at Daddy, who was next to me. I said, hey, what's this guy talking about, the horseshoe grip? He says, Daddy, across the seam and your finger. And I said, I don't know that. I don't know that. So I asked him, I said, but do you know that? He says, yes. We do it every time we practice, provincial practice, national practice, and it's a natural progression for you to grip the ball with this.
Yeah.
And I said, shoot, I've never, ever in my, I think at that time it was probably over 30 years of baseball, never, ever practiced that.
Mm.
I took the ball in my hand and I gripped it a certain way because I did a bit of pitching and I threw. And I made the ball do things that I wanted it to do. And that's how I found out what the ball could do if you did certain things. Whether it was wrong, whether it was right, but that's the way we did things.
Nice. So that's technique on the mound, right? So are you talking like a four-seam fastball kind of grip or just something?
The four-seam fastball.
That kind of first.
Now go ahead.
I was like that like first level of just understanding of how to, you know, play the position or again, what is the perceived correct way? So, I mean, I imagine whether it was pitching.
I'm going to take you back. When I said baseball was a summer recreation for most guys. Mervyn's first sport was soccer,
football,
soccer. He's assistant coach, top soccer coach. So they use sport in general and adapted it to baseball. We talk about the brand of baseball. We were a bunch of soccer players, our whole team, bunch of soccer players that could play baseball. And they utilized those skill sets and adapted the game plan to those skill sets. We weren't long ball hitters that could hit the ball, home runs all the time, but we could run the bases. So what do? We just put the ball on the ground and they run them silly. And they couldn't adapt to that. And we were termed to be playing bush baseball. I don't know what is bush baseball, but if it gets under your skin, then it becomes bush baseball. If you get whooped your ass, it becomes bush baseball. But we can't hit it over the fence, but we can run around the bases. You know, so they use those subtleness to keep you out of teams. Yeah, they set you up, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they push you off to turn your back on it. And they said, well, he was invited. We didn't chase him away. But I can't be invited at 4 o'clock on a Monday afternoon. You know, and that is just one of the examples. You know, the colored community is very church and family orientated. They want to do a practice at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. He says, hey, but that is our church time. That Sunday is our family time. Well, you were invited. You didn't pitch. You know, then you get sidetracked. Yeah, so those are the subtleness and but it's when you get under the skin, when you compete into them with when they become exposed, they use those silliness to get at you.
So just to clarify, it's funny. You said that they're calling you bush baseball, whatever it is. In America we would call something bush league, right? Not in line with how we think the game should be played, right? There's a ton of respectability and historical context issues in baseball where it's really entrenched in tradition and how things are supposed to be done. So once you and the color community have developed this brand and style and type of baseball that works for you, right? That works for the fields where it's getting, you know, pretty beat up and used over and over and over again, right? So you have to design a brand of baseball that fits that mode as well as fits the not having raised mounds, not having helmets or multiple bats, et cetera. So when you bring that brand to compete against the white teams in the fall of apartheid and you're competing with them and they say, you know, we can hit balls 400 feet. We can throw the ball really hard or whatever it is. And your brand pushes back against that or your type of baseball says, you know, there's other unconventional ways to look at this, right? Then they start to feel a type of way, but they even feel worse if you're beating them at the same time too. So they had to bring those structural tactics to disable baseball in your community, to make it more difficult for you to be decision makers in the league, to make it difficult for you to have your own, you got to have your own field, you got to have your own raised mound, right? You know, there's so many lands rights issues as is, and they know what they're doing when they say everybody has to have their own field, or we're not going to share our gloves with you at this game, et cetera, whatever it is. So those higher level tactics, once they couldn't compete with you on a game to game level, definitely showed out. So, I mean, you've spoken a lot about the little nitpicky things that they did to try to make it more difficult for you to play. Can you describe some of just the emotions and feelings you had from going from competing in all colored, you know, community environments to you got to go out to Belleville and start playing against guys who you either don't know or not really sure what it is and what that felt like in the fall of apartheid?
Well, for me, I just wanted to play. But knowing that the cards were stacked against you, because at the start is the whole administration is white. The umpiring association is white. So you got everything stacked against you. I mean, I think I got thrown out of the game three times in the first season of unification because I vented my frustration. You know, I didn't just sit there and keep my hand on my lips and just build up. A lot of guys did that. I was just on the flip side. I just vented my frustration. And just to think that people would use, after the new dispensation, they'll still use it against you to try and beat you. You know, so it was stacked up against you. Nobody gave us a chance. I think in the first season, we were the top team. We ended fifth. But as we started getting used to this thing, they became weary of us and they needed to stunt us somehow.
And then they started poaching the players.
Yeah.
To stunt you some more, they started poaching the players. So players were targeted. I want you, I want you, I want you. And they started paying those players to move to the bigger white clubs. Because all the bigger clubs were white clubs. And that is how our growth was stunted as well, because our key players took the bait and then moved on.
Very interesting. There are a lot of synergies between segregated baseball in South Africa and segregated baseball in America. And in the fall of the Negro Leagues here in America, a lot of it was a product of the best players going to go compete and play for, quote unquote, the biggest teams or biggest clubs with the most money and not necessarily better, right? When Negro League teams started to compete against white teams and little like off competitions or all-star games or just in barnstorming competitions or get the American League all-stars versus a Negro League team, whatever it is, those Negro League teams would win those competitions and people would kind of like look at it sideways in a way. But once money got involved, once status got involved, once all these other factors came into play, then that started to kind of disperse baseball within the black community here and started to pick out that talent and take it to, you know, the white teams and where you might gain resources or you might gain better coaching or understanding or whatever it is, you lose that community feeling and lose that pride that you really once held onto. So getting those players poached was another tactic that, again, helped to debilitate baseball even more.
That's right, yeah. They decentralize. They sort of take out the key players, so you take three steps back and start building again. I think what saved Athlone for a good while is we had a good youth system. We're producing the numbers in the youth system. We had one of the biggest youth programs in the late 90s, early 2000s. Probably up to 150 youth players going through the program. So that was a good thing for Athlone, and it sustained them to a point. So, and we could always turn over. So, okay, one of the better players left. Is there another one we're going to pick up along the way? Take a little bit longer to develop, but it came through. But also the youth program that we had, they started attracting other players to come and join the program. You see, it wasn't about, and we were approached about poaching players. And I, at the time I was the chairman, I said, I can't stop a player who wants to join a better program. I can say we won't approach a player, we won't make any offerings because we didn't have the financial backing to make any offerings.
We never paid anybody.
Well, I mean, we can't even discount some of one of our kids' subscription fees. So we don't have the financial backing to poach players. But if a player wishes to join a better program, how do we stop them? So when I was the chairperson, that was I advocated. Let's have the best program going so we can attract kids to our program. Kids and other players, even senior players, to our program. And it happened. In that sense, we raised our game. I mean, we were perennial second or third position finishes. Then we, in that period, we won the league at one stage, and we lost the league on two occasions on the last day. On two occasions, we lost the league on the last day. So the program was, we were up in the program, and we were competitive, and we attracted better quality players coming through the system.
It seems like you have this moment of unification with the Wolves and with the Dynamo, and for the next two decades or so, you work really creatively, work hard to figure out how to navigate the new world, right? You figure out how do we approach this? We have to have an incredible youth system to keep the talent within the community up, right? We need to compete in a certain type of way. We need to figure out how to make a raised mound in the dirt, right? Just even that process of building a mound up, those little things add up. So obviously Athlone, the Athletics are still a very strong program, have a lot of infrastructure that has taken a lot of time to develop and get there. Can you speak to the other, you know, programs or other leagues, right? We talk about I know the Maitland Giants are still around. The Westford Yankees are still around. Which community had a really big, robust league you spoke of?
Lineberg, Gershie Park.
So those neighborhoods had their own leagues, correct? Or their own teams?
So are we talking pre-unification?
I'm talking pre-unification, right? I'm trying to understand why the A's were able to survive in the way that they did, and why some other teams may have faltered or ran into bumps in the road and trying to stay alive, right? As you guys worked creatively to stay alive.
Creatively important. We consolidated with a merger, but we had visionary people leading us. You know, we knew Rome was not built in a day. I mean, we had committee members working tirelessly, writing up programs. How are we going to sustain it? We had one of the best development programs. We attached ourselves to schools. Schools are within walking distance from the facility. The kids are at the schools, so take the game to the school. The kids are not going to walk across to the game if they don't know the game. We had one of our top coaches going around to the various schools, just introducing the game and say, if you're really interested, this is where we, on a Friday afternoon, this is where our training sessions are. And that's how we attracted the numbers. Then we also, the visionary thinkers, yes, we didn't have a field. I mean, Darren probably told you it took us 17 years to get our field. We were nomading around. They were mercenaries around. They were hiding their field stars. We were so desperate to get the field. We were playing exorbitant amount of money to utilize fields. Then we were also prostituted, if you can use that word. They utilized us because we had a good brand of baseball. They had a fancy field and said, okay, we'll give you the field. You're going to bring the revenue for us. So they bought.
Yeah.
2 years we had a field. We could use the field for nothing, but we could do nothing to it. We couldn't practice over there. We could just go and play there on a Saturday. So they prostituted us to get their revenue. Because we got nothing out of the deal besides having the field available to us.
And we attracted the numbers.
And we had the biggest funding for probably out of the first 15 years, probably 10 of those years, we had one of the biggest followings, spectator-wise, not only playing-wise. We had a big player base, but we also had bringing new people to the game. Parents, junior parents, had started following us, watching our games. And at our games, we had the biggest, I mean, baseball doesn't grow big crowd in South Africa. But at Athlone games, it was the biggest crowd pullers to a point.
Got you. In terms of In terms of those visionary thinkers, and anybody who comes to mind in particular who really helped push you forward, and then just generally, right, this all sounds like a difficult task to really keep the club alive, to keep baseball alive, to keep going. What was your biggest inspiration and the thing that really made it all worthwhile? I know you said you wanted to play, you just wanted to play, but beside that, what kept you going?
Once I started playing and I started seeing the challenges, I didn't play long. I played 3 years and the playing side didn't get the enjoyment out of the playing side anymore because it became frustrating. Stumbling blocks were being put in your way. You turn left, there's something there, you need to turn left again. And it's just difficult to get around. And I started utilizing my skills and started coaching. In 23 years, I was probably 28 when I went into coaching. But I could have been in the prime of my baseball career. I then started coaching because I think we had a shortage of coaches. And I started picking my brain and picking people's brain and started seeing how I can outsmart the opponents. And I went into coaching, but before that, we had probably two of the forefathers of athlone, Mervin and Roderick Solia. I don't know, you met Rod? You spoke to Roderick Solia. Rod had the vision. Mervin and I supported the vision. Mervin and Rod did all the hard work, the planning, the plotting, and how we're going to go forward. And we were just tagged along and implemented the vision. I mean, Darren's mom will know we would sit here till 3-4 o'clock in the morning, Rod in Joburg, to us to source some funding for our program. We need to write up a proposal, but the proposal must be, that time it had to be faxed off by 8 o'clock in the morning, so we had to work through the night. I mean, we had to go work to our employees the next day, but at that stage, it's just not to give the white man his way, that you'll see us fall, to show them that we can't. I say we overextended ourselves. I mean, many a night. I mean, I don't think for the first 15 years we had an off season. Write up programs during the off season. What we're going to do next year? Plan and plot what we're going to do this season. Try and get the buy-in of the players. I mean, although the season starts in October, where the guys come in developing their skills from June already, June, July, once a week. When you finish your soccer, come down here, let's develop skills so we can be better next year, so we can stand our own against these guys. The first 5 years, they thought we were nothing, but after that, I mean, besides that, there were other colored clubs that really gave the white clubs a go, and they realized that, listen, baseball's not their own. Like I was often told that they've been playing baseball for 30 years. I asked the question, do you think we were playing marbles for 30 years? And they spoke like there was no baseball. The first time we seen baseball was in 1994. But we were talking about baseball in the 60s and 70s. Do we play the game? Not, as you say, not...
not in the same facilities.
Not the facilities and not the... the expectation that they want the game to be played at. But we had to adapt the facilities we utilized, the resources we had, the little resources we had, the opportunities that we didn't have. So we utilized those skills. We utilized the skill set, and that's where Mervin says, building a type of brand. What skill sets do we have? How can we enhance this skill set? This is the way we can enhance it. So for me, Roderick and Mervin were the pioneers of setting the roadmap for us. There was a few of us that tagged along, myself, Maurice, Tony, who else was there? Pluggy.
Yeah.
There were 5-6 of us that tagged along, that did the dirty work and the gopher work. But the roadmap was set. This is how we're going to get to the destination. There was bumps.
There were many bumps.
I mean, we sidetracked, we followed, we went off the path, we had to come back on the path. Some of us thought, no, this is not going to happen, not in our lifetime, but
I think the best thing we ever did was we met and we had decided it's going to be Wolves, Dynamos, you're going to merge. We got an advocate in, a friend of a friend, to sit in and listen to the story. and all who were interested from both clubs sat. I think we sat in somebody's flat on the floor. There weren't enough seats. And we plotted through what we wanted to do. Cut a long story short, we took whatever each one had. Your uniforms, your equipment, our uniforms, our equipment, and we pooled it all. We put it down there and we started on zero. Whatever money they had, and they had, Dynamos had very little, and whatever money we had, we pooled. So that we're kicking off. The best thing that ever happened thereafter was never to have a double barrel new club name. There was not going to be a Wolves Dynamos or Dynamos Wolves. So we put it out there to 10, what do you want this club to be for the next whenever? And he mentioned the one guy, Pluggy, was his nickname, and he came up with the idea of Athlone Athletics based on Oakland Athletics. And you can see our branding is based on there. He went as far as to write to them to ask whether we could be a subsidiary of Oakland Athletics. And I mean, there was some yes, no. We didn't get that far. We then, the only thing we did was we adapted the colors of both clubs. So there's blues and grays, there's golds and blacks. So those were the four colors we incorporated in our uniforms. And that always went ahead. We were going to either use two or three of whatever color was needed for home and away kits. And that's how it went. And I think that in itself was the kicking point that we started on this new name. Then, because it was Athlone Athletics and Sean mentioned Roderick, he then made the statement and said, if we're going to be Athlone Athletics, we want to be, and we will be, the only baseball club in Athlone. And we will be, and we want to be, the biggest club in Athlone. And that was the vision. That was the broad vision. And as years went on, we narrowed it down that we did become the biggest club. And we became the most successful club. Those things were done. And we had it all planned in 5 years and 10 years and 15 years. We sometimes missed the five-year mark and went into 5.5, and the 10 became a 12, but we got there. We got the clubhouse. It took 17 years, but we got it. And we got it better than what we thought it would be. Those were the things. And Sean doesn't take a lot of credit for his input, because myself and Roderick, being the elder statements in its the statesman in the club, we've seen the likes of Sean, we've seen his potential, and we slowly drew him closer within the fold to eventually become the leader of the club, which he did.
So definitely a lot of incredible takeaways and stories in the fight to adapt post the fall of apartheid, the fight to come together and band together, even when, times might have been uncertain or up in the air. And I'm definitely very thankful for Sean and Mervin of sharing their stories and the story of how the athletics came about. And as we transition into part two, we're going to get into more of what did that hard work bear? Who received the fruits of all the labor and investment that people like Sean and Mervin and others at the club put into it? So thank you for listening, and please listen into part two.